This is a download from Newstalk 106 to 108. To download other programmes or for more information, go to newstalk.ie.
And Ireland, long a province be, a nation once again. A nation once again. A nation once again. And Ireland, long a province be, a nation once
again. A nation once again, sung there by the one and only Luke Kelly. Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on Newstalk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. And in tonight's show, we're looking at the life and legacy of Thomas Davis. On this, the bicentenary of his birth, the man who gave us, of course, A Nation Once Again and many other ballads. And we'll be debating whether he deserves his reputation as the man who gave Ireland a soul. Then in the second hour, we'll be hearing some of the first-hand accounts of Mayo participants in the War of Independence. We'll be finding out about the 69 men from a Cork suburb who enlisted in the First World War and never made it back. We'll be refighting the Battle of Waterloo with a leading military historian and exploring whether the choice of terrain helped Wellington win. And then to end the show, we'll be discussing the lives of Irish political prisoners in the period 1912 to 1921 and looking at the use of the hunger strike as a political weapon. Now, don't forget, if you want to comment on any of our items, you can text the show at any time on 53106, that's for 30 cents. You can call us on our local 1890 number, that's 453106, or you can email us at talkinghistory@newstalk.ie. And I especially hope that all of the fans of Tipperary and Kilkenny who will be on their way home tonight will listen in and maybe send us a text. They will have a hurling final once again coming up, but I don't think either side will be too disappointed after that epic of a game. This is, of course, our first show back after the summer break. We're looking forward to the 8th year of Talking History, and we have some good shows planned for you over the next few months. So we're delighted to be back and looking forward to bringing you some Talking History over the next few months. Now, don't forget, if you want to listen back to any of our older shows, you just go to our website, newstalk.ie, or go directly to iTunes. Also, just to let you know about the great History Festival of Dublin that's taking place at the end of this month. It's taking place starting on Friday the 26th of September and running all the way into the first week of October. And this year, the Dublin History Festival sees Dublin remembering the First World War, and it's going to be one of the major themes of this year's festival. And you can find out about all of the events. They're of course free of charge, but you can book online at www.dublinfestivalofhistory.ie. This is the second year of the Dublin Festival of History, and some great events are there on the list, and some just to bring to your attention. On the 1st of October at 6:30 in the Marina Library, James Curry will be giving a talk on Rosie Hackett, the trade unionist, and of course the newest bridge in Dublin is named after her. And then on the 4th of October at 10:30 a.m. in the Council Chamber of City Hall, there is a special panel debating the Home Rule issue, and it's the Home Rule centenary debate. And that's something I'm involved in myself, so hope to see you at that. But a great series of events planned by the Dublin Festival of History, and you can find more details about that online. Now, tonight's debate is on Thomas Davis. Born in Mallow in County Cork in October 1814, Thomas Osborne Davis was educated in Dublin and became a leading figure in the debating society at Trinity College Dublin, the College Historical Society, where he outlined his ideas on Irish nationality, declaring, "Gentlemen, you have a country." A contributor to various newspapers and magazines, he impressed with his poetry and writings and became a key figure in Daniel O'Connell's repeal movement. In 1842, he founded the Nation newspaper with the motto to create and foster public opinion to the great end of nationality, and he became its principal contributor. His ballad, A Nation Once Again, was one of his most popular works and became a rallying cry for future generations. Part of a younger group of reformers, dubbed Young Ireland, Davis was reduced to tears during a heated debate with Daniel O'Connell over university education, and it marked the beginning of a permanent split. Engaged to be married, Davis died of scarlet fever on the 16th of September 1845, still only 30 years old. On his tombstone was written a line from one of his poems, "He served his country and loved his kind." In the years afterwards, Davis's influence was immense, and he was hailed as a maker of modern Ireland, an icon to later nationalists such as Arthur Griffith, Patrick Pearse and Eamon de Valera. So in tonight's show, we want to assess his life and his legacy. What did Davis really achieve? Why was he so inspirational? And 200 years on from his birth, how should we remember him? Well, to help me address these questions and more, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Dr. James Quinn is the Managing Editor of the Royal Irish Academy's Dictionary of Irish Biography, and he's just completed a book on Young Ireland and the Writing of History. Gavin Finlay did his MPhil History thesis at Trinity College Dublin on the legacy of Thomas Davis. A qualified school teacher, he holds a postgraduate diploma in education from NUI Galway, and he's an expert on commemoration and memory in modern Irish history, nationalism, and the uses and abuses of history. Dr. Eust Augustine lectures in history at Leiden University and is an expert on modern Irish and British history, and his books include Patrick Pearse, The Making of a Revolutionary. Well, you're all very welcome, and later in the show we'll also be talking to Dr. Kieran O'Neill of the Department of History at Trinity College Dublin about the legacy of Davis. But Gavin, I might begin with you, and especially given that today was the All-Ireland hurling final between Tipperary and Kilkenny, you might take us back to the All-Ireland hurling final of 1945, which was also between Tipperary and Kilkenny, because there was a very interesting Thomas Davis connection then.
That's right, Patrick. Thanks for having me on. So in the 2nd of September 1945, that year's All-Ireland hurling final between the same two teams as today, I think Tipperary won that day 5-6 to 3-6. Before the game began, there was an enormous pageant involving the Artane's Boys Band and other organisations, and it was a pageant to remember Davis, and this was the week ahead of the week-long commemoration of Davis's death in 1845. And school children and so on paraded on the pitch with big banners, you know, lettering Davis, Pearse, Eyre and so on. And the ballad that you began the show with, "A Nation Once Again," was played by the band as well. Now, I'm not sure how much of the crowd that day knew what was going on, because at the time, Davis had kind of fallen into somewhat of an oblivion in terms of Irish history, and I think the week that followed was an attempt by the Fianna Fáil government and the state to educate and resurrect Davis's memory for a new generation.
Very good. And why was he so important for Eamon de Valera? Why was he so important to that party that was in power? Why were they so determined to reclaim him and ensure that he wasn't left for oblivion?
Like all centenaries and commemorations, there is an element of politics involved here, and it was opportunistic on the part of Fianna Fáil to use Davis's memory for political purposes, to make the party more popular and so on. But it was also about looking back to Davis being this father of an Irish nation, his teachings on the Irish language, on being proud of Irish history and nationhood, his advocacy of cross-creed equality and a potential unifier between North and South and the Catholic majority and the Protestant minority. And Fianna Fáil, indeed all, you know, Irish nationalist parties were well aware of Davis's power and his influence, you know.
Thanks a million for joining us from Holland. I'm interested in this idea of Davis and his legacy on successive generations, because you wouldn't automatically think that someone like Pearse would be so inspired by Davis, because you could understand maybe why Pearse admired Robert Emmet, a youthful revolutionary hero, but Davis seems to be a kind of a different kind of nationalist.
Indeed. Thanks for having me on as well. In a sense, Davis is not really a violent man, and when Pearse was coming to his, particularly in his later years, was very much an admirer of people who were in favour of violence. But to achieve an independent nation. But in his earlier years, of course, Pearce was a cultural nationalist, very much and deeply interested in the contribution of culture to nationalism. And really where Thomas Davis stands out for Pearce as well is the fact that he introduced culture and the Irish language in a narrower sense, but in a wider culture, in a wider sense as well, to Irish nationalism, which hadn't really been an element before Thomas Davis.
And you sponsored?
Well, no, that is just the big added quality. Because if you look back before Thomas Davis, at Daniel O'Connell or even Wolfe Tone, Wolfe Tone is very much a Republican in a French revolutionary sense, in a citizens are not governed properly by the British, so therefore we should be independent. And O'Connell also had difficulty with what makes Irish people stand out from British people, apart from the fact that we're not governed well. And for O'Connell, that was Catholicism in a sense. So Davis brought in culture as a unifying force, and that was the big thing that Pearce saw.
And is there a sense that Davis was another lost leader? The fact that he died at such a young age, he died before the famine, he died even, I suppose, before the split, the major split with O'Connell. And therefore people could project onto him whatever vision of the future they wanted.
You could say there's an element of that, all right. It's safe because you can attribute anything to him in a sense. Although the fact that Davis was a fairly mild-mannered man and not in favour of of force or even speed or revolution. He wanted an independent state, but he could take it in stages, and he was not that far removed from O'Connell's policy. So that was difficult for Pearce and also for Republicans after Pearce, who used Davis as well. But in a sense, because you don't really know whether he would have been part of the 1848 Young Irelanders revolution, you could argue that he would have been, and that made it easier for people.
Very good, James. It's interesting what you said there about him being a mild-mannered man, and when you look at his writings, he does come across maybe as a little bit earnest, but yet he inspired great devotion in those around him, and they certainly saw a man of great passion and energy.
Yes, Patrick, that's very, very true. I mean, the word you use is earnest. The other word that's often been used about him is solemn. But along with these qualities, he seems to have had some kind of charisma that doesn't really come out from his correspondence, for example, which is often quite flat. A lot of his essay writings, again, can be a little uninspiring. But he does seem to have had a personal charisma. I mean, colleagues of his, for example, like John Mitchell and Charles Gavan Duffy, who became very, very bitter enemies, and they agreed on very, very little. But one thing they did agree on was the fact that one of the most remarkable men they ever met was Thomas Davis. And I think, in a way, he had certain qualities. He had a combination of vision and drive that really inspired those people around him.
If we look at his life, and maybe if we start with his time in Trinity, you kind of see the beginnings of his public career there in the addresses he gave to the Historical Society and the beginnings of, I suppose, a vision for Irish nationalism.
Yeah, those addresses really in the early 1840s are really the beginnings of the Young Ireland movement. And in a way, they're rallying cries. In those addresses, he tells people, you know, gentlemen, you have a country. He tells them about the importance of Irish history. It's important for them to know that history, and it's important for them to be proud of that history. So these are the ideas then that are publicized at much greater length in the Nation newspaper from 1842 onwards. And, I mean, Davis writes, you know, the bulk of the Nation. He writes most of the historical verse. He writes most of the essays, the editorials, and so on. And I mean, at one stage, the Nation, according to Duffy, reached a quarter of a million people. So I mean, it was the most important nationalist organ, really, I think, of the 19th century, and certainly of the 1840s. So in that way, Davis's words reached a very, very large audience.
It's funny when you look at the time in Trinity. He doesn't seem to have been an exceptional student. He seems to have been somewhat disillusioned with the curriculum that was on offer and read books that weren't being studied. And his constant refrain, even in later years, was educate so that you will be free, and that he seems to have strong views on it. Today, of course, Trinity has a lecture theatre in the arts block named after him. But his contribution seems to have been more in the debate society than it was in the classroom, and what he picked up seems to have been more outside of the classroom than in it.
That's very true, and the slogan, you know, educate that you might be free, is something that he applied very much to himself as well, because I've been very struck going through Davis's papers at the numbers of subjects he manages to cover. He's massive notes for a whole variety of projects. Actually, one of them was A Dictionary of Irish Biography, which he didn't quite get around to. But a series of other things, you know, a history of the Cromwellian Wars, a military history of 1798, a series of short lives of famous Irish people. And the notes, as I say, you know, they cover medieval history, early modern. He has notes on historical developments in India, in Canada. So, if you like, he did promote education as the key to liberty, but in a sense too for himself. Self-education was the key to him being a central public figure in Irish life.
And of course, Gavin, in Trinity, he would have been the friends that he made, the people that he was hanging out with, were hugely important. And I suppose being part of a group of Catholics as well as Protestants, he was getting a sense of all different kinds of views and perspectives.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, the context, you know, 1830s, 40s there in Trinity College, you're seeing a new generation of, you know, a Catholic middle class being educated at Trinity College, which is a fairly, you know, relatively new thing, you know. And Davis was certainly influenced by his as he would call it, my Catholic countrymen. And I think it did influence his views on, you know, Irish national identity and, you know, his dream of a future Irish nation. And just following from what James said about, you know, his teaching of history and so on, his belief in the importance of history, I mean, he believed, you know, that honouring the great deeds and men of the past was more important than, like, the material well-being of the country now. He thought that, you know, no other nation forgets their great men or their dead heroes or their patriots. And it's interesting that, like, in the decades that came after his death, certainly 100 years later, that kind of what happened with Davis. He himself was remembered so importantly.
And what about the Irish language? That was something that was very important to him, but yet he didn't have it himself.
Yeah, that's very true. I mean, of course, certainly, you know, in the 1945 commemorations, the Irish language was a huge issue, obviously, for the new state. And, you know, Davis, of course, himself wrote that, you know, a nation without a language is only half a nation. And, you know, a nation should guard its language more closely than its own frontiers, you know, and than its territories. You know, it's a sure way to protect the nation than defending its borders. So he said, you know, he did really believe in the importance of the Irish language. But yes, it is quite ironic that in the nation itself, there's very few Irish language articles, if any, I think. And later on, he was criticised by some Irish language bodies and, you know, Gaelic ideologues or fanatics that said, well, Davis did nothing really for the language apart from kind of romantic rhetoric and so on. In fact, he was an enemy of the Gaelic nation because it was Anglicisation in the 19th century that kind of spread this new nationalism in many ways.
Okay, well, we're talking history. We are talking history on our first show back after our summer break, and we are talking about the life and legacy of Thomas Davis. We're going to take a very quick break now. When we come back, we'll be talking about his role in the repeal movement, his clash with Daniel O'Connell, and we'll be finding out just how much an influence was the nation.
Talking History with Patrick Gagan on News Talk 106 to 108.
Well, welcome back to Talking History as we look at the life and legacy of Thomas Davis with James Quinn, Gavin Finlay and Eust Augustine. Now, James, maybe you could talk to us about how Davis got involved in the repeal movement. You know, how did he get involved in that? And he seems to have made himself central to it at a very early stage.
Yeah, well, he would have gotten involved from the early 40s, even before the founding of the nation. He joined the Repeal Association. And Daniel O'Connell was particularly delighted to have, you know, an educated, articulate Protestant figure in the Repeal Association, because opponents of Repeal tried to paint it as a Catholic sectarian movement. But for a nationalist like Davis, and I mean, Davis was primarily interested in cultural nationalism, but the way you can promote cultural nationalism is through having a legislature of your own. So certainly in that way, repeal of the Union was a minimum demand for Davis and the Young Ireland group that focused around him. So for most of the first few years, he and O'Connell get on relatively well. They've different emphases, but it doesn't really come out in public too much. The one occasion when it does is when they start debating the new what were called godless colleges. New universities were founded. They weren't to have theological faculties. Davis agreed with this. O'Connell didn't, and most of the Catholic bishops didn't. And in one famous debate, Davis was actually reduced to tears because of his disagreement with O'Connell because of this. There were other disagreements as well on federalism, for example. O'Connell at one stage, after the failure in Clontarf, when the repeal movement really didn't know what direction to go in, O'Connell was imprisoned for almost a year. When he came out, he toyed with the idea of some sort of federal arrangement. And by nationalists like Davis, this was seen as a kind of betrayal. Repeal of the Union was the minimum demand. They didn't want some sort of watered-down home rule.
And it's interesting, you know, when you look at the clash with O'Connell, because even the name Young Ireland kind of emerges from O'Connell championing Old Ireland and being dismissive of these young guns who he kind of, you know, throws away as an insult the name Young Ireland.
Well, most people did, actually. I mean, it was a mocking nickname, really, for the movement, because actually it primarily came from as a reference to the Young England movement that contained people like Lord John Manners and Benjamin Disraeli and so on. And someone thought that the Young Irelanders spoke in the same way, had some similar ideas. So in a way, actually, people who were involved in the Young Ireland movement only adopted the name themselves 30 or 40 years onwards. They more or less gave in to, if you like, you know, public opinion and start describing themselves in that way. But at the time, in the 1840s, it was considered a bit of a joke.
Okay, you've done a lot of work on Young Ireland and the writing of history, and you've looked at Davis and all of these clashes. The clash with O'Connell, what side are you on in that? Because, you know, O'Connell can come across as maybe a bit bullying in that. He picks on Davis. He kind of accuses him of being sectarian and pretty much destroys Davis in that debate until finally Davis comes out with the line, "Some of my best friends are Catholic," which is never a good line to use when you're accused of prejudice. And then to break down in tears, that he definitely seems to come off worst in that confrontation.
Well, he certainly does, but I mean, he's up against a serious political bruiser in O'Connell. I mean, who, as you well know, had honed his skills in the courtrooms up and down the land. And Davis was a relatively inexperienced debater, and I don't think he thought on his feet as well as O'Connell did. So in terms of sides, well, I don't necessarily think historians have to take sides, but I mean, afterwards, even I think, in that particular debate, I think O'Connell himself thought he went a bit far, because when Davis did break down, he crossed the table and offered him his hand. And certainly when Davis died, which wasn't that much later, O'Connell was genuinely distraught. You know, and I would think perhaps to some extent from a feeling that maybe he'd crushed Davis a little too cruelly back in that original debate.
And if we look at the influence of the Nation then, he was the founder, one of the co-founders of the Nation. You mentioned the circulation there and the fact that Davis was writing so much of it. I suppose it's hard for us to to think like it was such an influential paper. And what was Davis writing? It's poems, ballads, history writing. It seems to be a bit of everything.
It's everything. Yeah, it's editorials. He writes long essays. And he writes quite a lot of historical verse generally, but most of it being historical verse. And he himself realizes that the place where they have the greatest success is with the historical verse. Because also, I mean, you're talking about literacy levels of around 45% to 50% in the early 1840s. So, but people who aren't literate can actually memorize ballads. And of course, this is the great period of the recitation and so on. So at various events or parties or whatever, young and not so young people would have their recitation. And very often it would end up being Davis's, you know, A Nation Once Again, or even more so things like Fontenoy, Clare's Dragoons, The Sack of Baltimore. So in a way, away from, if you like, the academic side of history, the more literary side of things, his words earn a place in, you know, around Irish homesteads and become part of the fabric of Irish life.
Yeah. And would he have supplied the music to go along with these, or did that come later, or how did that work?
That generally came later, yeah. I mean, sometimes you've people like John Pigott who end up putting the words to music and so on. And sometimes the Nation will suggest a particular tune, but generally he would just supply the words. Yeah,
very good. And Youse, then, when we look at his, I suppose, his particular style of nationalism, how does that compare with, or how does it contrast with, other nationalist leaders in that century or over that period?
Well, I think there's really one major thing that he contributed is that the kind of nationalism was either narrow on one hand or violent on the other hand. Narrow in a Catholic sense or in a purely independent sense, or wanted independent from Britain, and like Mitchell was a very anti-British nationalism. And Davis really brought something that could unite all Irish people into a nationalism, Protestants as well as Catholics. And it is also that the kind of nationalism which he brought was had a content, a real cultural content. And I think he really introduced that. Pierce, I think, picks up on that re-injected it really into, together with the Gaelic League and all people that were associated with that, of course, at the end of the 19th century, into Irish nationalism. So Davis really started that that current, and that is hugely influential because that really defines Irish nationalism today.
And Youse, was he influential in his own lifetime? How much of it was the fact that later generations took their inspiration from him and found something in his writings that really resonated with them? And how much what would he have been recognized for that in his own lifetime? Would they have said, oh, here's Davis, we're learning so much from him, he's inspiring us to think of our country in a different way?
Well, I think it was fairly limited, but not completely absent. I mean, the Nation was fairly well read. And as James was saying, you know, Thomas Davis wrote most of what was in The Nation, the newspaper. So in that sense, his thinking was certainly resonating with some people, but he was on the fringes. I mean, it was not mainstream thinking, what he was thinking at the time of his life. And really with, you know, cultural nationalism that came up later, then he became influential. And I think really Pierce is the one who really highlights that. For him, he's one of the four fathers of Irish nationalism, of Irish freedom. You know, Pierce sees that as a very one of the main contributors to what Irish nationalism was, and that is something really that came after his life. And so he was not ignored. His thinking was accepted as an interesting thought, but it was not really mainstream thinking in those days.
And you mentioned the four. Who were the other three?
Mitchell, Wolfe, Tone, and Fintan Lawler. Those were the four fathers of Irish freedom, as Pierce called them.
Very good. And James, talk to us then about the death of Davis. He died, you know, a few weeks before his 31st birthday. Scarlet fever. Was it in any way connected with the stress of the times, or was it just something that he contracted?
I think it may have been. I mean, he worked himself very, very hard. In addition, you know, to his writings, his political organization work, he wasn't someone who got a whole lot of sleep. And he, in the years before he died, he had a couple of recurring bouts of scarlet fever. And, of course, the problem with, you know, all infectious diseases at this time is there's no effective cure. I mean, there wasn't even actually a vaccine for scarlet fever. And the only effective cure actually even today is antibiotics, which, you know, wouldn't have been used generally until 100 years after Davis died. So the thing about it being, and actually it's a common enough theme in the Young Irelanders. There are others, you know, Thomas McNevin, Joseph Brennan, Thomas Devon Riley, all of whom die before they reach their 30th birthday.
And in a way, the fact that he died before, I suppose, the famine hit the country, before the 1848 rebellion, it meant that he wasn't, I suppose, he wasn't forced to get involved. He wasn't forced to make a decision with respect to the rebellion, and in a way, his reputation was untainted by any association.
Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, in a way, you know, he dies as the pure, young, unsullied patriot. You know, perhaps if he'd had a longer career, he would have had to make, you know, a lot more compromises and so on. I mean, it might be interesting to compare him with his contemporary, his fellow founder of the nation, Charles Gavan Duffy, who, you know, lived until, I think it was 1903, and had a very long political career, which involved making a lot of political compromises and also involved taking on a knighthood, which most Irish nationalists didn't approve of too highly. And for a lot of people, actually, Duffy became almost a kind of hate figure for nationalists. I mean, one of the reasons for the popularity, I think, of John Mitchell was that among certain kind of nationalists, especially separatists, was that he and Duffy were such mortal enemies, you know?
Very good. Okay. Now, before we went on air, I talked to my friend and colleague, Dr. Kieran O'Neill of Trinity College Dublin. It was not the greatest of telephone lines because Kieran is over in Brazil. He's been in Brazil the whole summer on a major research trip, doing some great work. I'm sure the fact that the World Cup was on there was purely coincidental in his thinking. So I had a great chat with him about the legacy of Davis and why he's not better remembered. And on that shaky line to Brazil, I began by asking him about why he isn't more of a household name, and is he somewhat something of a forgotten man?
I think it's true to say he isn't a household name in the same way that, you know, a Pierce or a Robert Emmett are, and I think that's partly to do with his personality. He wasn't a particularly dynamic character, and in fact, in his 1890 biography, Gavan Duffy spends the first 50 pages of the biography kind of apologizing for the fact that nobody had noticed Thomas Davis until he was about 25 or 26. And we still know very little about his childhood and adolescence. And in a sense, he's quite a quiet figure for most of his life. He's a sort of an attic scribbler. He's a bit of a nerd writing romantic ballads in his mother's house on Baggot Street. But, you know, I mean, even with all of that, it's kind of hard not to like Davis. He dies young. He's untainted by the failure of 1848. He's the romantic heart of the Young Ireland movement. You know, he's very quotable. He's secular, inclusive, big on education, big on improvement. And, you know, he was big on raising the general standard of literacy and living in Ireland. But I think this is the reason we should take him seriously. I think he should be more visible. He's had a sort of persistent under-the-radar influence on Irish popular culture ever since his early death. You can see his embedded influence everywhere, you know, particularly in Irish nationalist culture, in popular music. He retains a really strong presence among Irish language advocates as well as educationists. And, of course, he has the obligatory GAA club named after him, Thomas Davis in Tala. He has a statue in College Green, City Hall. And I know a lot of work has been going on in Mallow to reclaim him over the past year or two as well.
You mentioned the Irish language there, and are there some contradictions in Davis's output, though, because he was so strongly supportive of the Irish language, but yet he wasn't a Gael Gore himself?
Yeah, I mean, and it's funny because he's one of the poster bodies for the Irish language movement, and maybe rightly so. I mean, I was walking down earlier this year, walking down Nassau Street, And I saw a protest march kind of sweep up Dawson Street beside me, chanting Tiargan Seanga, Tiargan Annam, which is sort of a Patrick Pearce reworking of Thomas Davis's most famous quote, which is, people without a language of their own is only half a nation, which became a sort of a motto for the Gaelic League in the 1890s, did a lot to kind of obviously form Pearce himself, many of the 1916 leaders, and it's been popular as a phrase ever since. And I suppose the irony of that is that Davis, of course, wasn't an Irish language speaker with any great proficiency. He wasn't fluent. He made several attempts, I think, to learn the Irish language, but as far as I know, he was never successful. So there's a bit of irony in that, but I think people are probably a bit harsh on Davis for that.
And finally, and thanks a million, Karen, for joining us on the phone from Brazil on your research trip there. But can you talk to us maybe about where is his influence visible today? You mentioned in the GAA, you mentioned the Irish language. Is it worth commemorating him on this, the bicentenary of his birth? Is it worth us trying to reclaim him for the 21st century?
Yeah, I think so. As I said, for all those reasons that I mentioned earlier, he's quite inclusive. His vision for Ireland is one that's non-sectarian. He's kind of secular by nature. He's very progressive in terms of literacy and education policy generally. I mean, you can see his influence everywhere. I think the most obvious place that's worth mentioning is in the case of popular music, Patrick. If you grew up like I did in rural Ireland, you might well have attended a FESH or a SCORE competition at some stage, and another score, some of your listeners will know SCORE. Back in the 1980s and 1990s, it used to sort of teeter on the brink of being a sort of nationalist variety show where one group would inevitably sing a song for Ireland, another one would stand up and sing or recite the Ballad of the Tinker's Daughter or whatever. But my abiding memory of those events, going to them as a child, was that somebody would always stand up and absolutely murder Thomas Davis's A Nation Once Again, which is probably his most famous song. Now, there have been lots of good versions of that song recorded over the years by Luke Kelly, Clancy Brothers, and so on and so forth. And it's a really good song, but I think the reason for its longevity is this sort of rousing quality. It's the fact that it was printed cheaply and widely available on the streets of Dublin and elsewhere. And well, that collection ran to something like 59 editions by 1934. I mean, the other famous song is The West to Sleep, not The West to Wake, actually, which is what it's usually called, and maybe The Lament of Roan Roe O'Neill. And these are all very, very popular songs. They're still being recorded by people like Damien Dempsey, all the way up along through Irish folk and traditional song. So I think the influence is real, and I think it's certainly worth commemorating Thomas Davis at this point.
Okay, Dr. Kieran O'Neill from Trinity College Dublin, joining us all the way from Brazil. Thanks a million for coming on the show tonight.
Thanks, Patrick.
We'll be back with more on the legacy of Thomas Davis right after this.
Talking History with Patrick Gagan on News Talk 106 to 108.
Well, welcome back to Talking History as we look at the life and legacy of Thomas Davis with James Quinn, Gavin Finlay and Hugh Augustine. Gavin, maybe talk to us about the commemoration of Davis then over the years. Was 1945 the centenary of his death? Was that the high point of commemoration?
Yeah, absolutely, Patrick. It's important to say as well that in 1914 there was small-scale events to commemorate his birth, so 100 years ago this year, involving like National Literary Societies. Arthur Griffith, of course, spoke of Davis as being the great prophet and who he followed, and whose words and teachings have inspired him more than any other Irish nationalist figure. Of course, W.B. Yeats gave an address in Trinity as well at that time, which caused a bit of controversy back then when the Vice Provost Mahaffey actually refused to attend because of Patrick Pearce's attendance there due to his anti-British sentiments. But yeah, in 45, this was an enormous spectacle. It's hard to overstate that. I mean, it was the largest public history spectacle, I think, since the foundation of the state in 1922. I mean, he was arguably larger than the Duke of Connacht in 1932, certainly larger than the Emancipation Centenary in 1929. There was small events in 1942, but 1945, there was a Pacific week between the 9th and the 16th of September where you had, numerous organizations from all over the country involved, from cultural, literary, political, labor, sporting, Irish language, and so on. Now, the government were you know, adamant that this would be a great public spectacle. I mean, it was basically put public hagiography on a national scale to celebrate this this, you know, father of the Irish nation. I mean, you even had a military parade down O'Connell Street involving 4,000 troops with army jets flying overhead over Mount Rowan Cemetery. You had book fairs, you had bilingual dramas. You even had the government commission a film produced by the National Film Institute of Ireland, Radio Éireann, as it was known at the time, broadcast each day, coverage of the events. Public buildings were requested to fly national flags. Even shopkeepers were encouraged by the Irish press, no less, who of course were the propaganda mouthpiece for Fianna Fáil, of course, to, you know, proudly fly flags during the week. There were symphonies, there was reclaying, there was the foundation stone that was laid by Sean T. O'Callaghan, the president, there in College Green, which amazingly wasn't actually completed until 1966 in typical kind of Dublin City Council bureaucracy. And amazingly, the location for the statue that Kieran O'Neill mentioned there, that it stands in the site where William of Oring's statue used to stand, facing Trinity College's alma mater and outside the old House of Parliament. And Davis could be seen as a part of that long line of Protestant nationalists of, you know, Grattan, Flood, Tone and so on.
And they've commissioned a new statue, I know, for this, the bicentenary of his
and
birth.
I believe it's a replica of the statue in City Hall, which, very interestingly, I think, and faces Daniel O'Connell. They're actually opposite each other in the rotunda of City Hall, these two giants of 19th century history, but with very different visions of Irish nationhood.
Yeah, I know that the Commemoration Committee down in Mallow has done some brilliant work organising a series of events this month and next month, apart from the statue, I know, on PUS then as well, of a commemorative stamp that they're issuing, and they had some events of wreath laying at St. Drum's Cemetery.
And the current Provost Trinity College, Dr. Prendergast, actually gave a very moving speech on that occasion that I attended myself, actually. So it was interesting that it continued that connection with Trinity College, you know.
And they're planning a whole series of events then in October, and Tim Sheehan, the chairperson of that group, has done some brilliant work, and so I think you can find out details about that on the Mallow website, www.mallow.ie. But it shows that, you know, for the people of Mallow, Thomas Davis is a very important figure, and the fact that there's going to be an on-post commemorative stamp shows that more widely he's seen as. Could I bring you in on, I suppose, his wider cultural legacy? How significant was he really? I know we mentioned that Griffith and Pierce and De Valera all saw him as this prophet and this influential figure, but how much of that is real and how much of that is overstated?
Well, it's always hard to measure how people are influenced, but he hasn't really done very much, you know, concrete. He hasn't set up an Irish movement. He hasn't, with a lasting legacy. He's not founding member of the Gaelic League, which was impossible, of course. So all the cultural movements that really sprung up at the end of the 19th century, although, you know, used his writing in a sense that were possibly inspired by his writing, and some have explicitly said so. But in a concrete sense, these people have done the work, and he has not done the work. So, in that sense, it is overstated. But without him, would these people have done what they have done? You know, you really have to see it in that kind of context.
And used in the pantheon of Irish nationalist heroes, where exactly should Davis be placed?
I think he is should be one of the important thinkers about Irish nationalism, not the doers, in a sense. You know, they're far more influential people in the 19th and 20th century. But he made a real lasting contribution to the context of the ideology, in a sense. Also, you could argue a dangerous contribution. I think this idea of what you started with, that did he give a soul to Ireland? I think in a sense he did, in stating that there is an Irish nation which is more than a group of people who are Irish. You know, if that is what a nation is, it's just a group of people, then you can change your mind as a group of people. But he said, no, the Irish nation has a soul of itself, which is separate from the people that constitute that nation. And that can be a dangerous thought, because it can say then, look, the Irish nation is asking this of you, is demanding of you, regardless of what the majority thinks. And I think a lot of the fiscal force that has been used by Irish Republicans, by separatists, has been based upon that thinking. Not that he was necessarily in favour of that, although he was not averse to it necessarily. So, but he has brought in that element into Irish nationalism. So in that sense, he is influential in two ways, in a cultural sense as well as in a separatist sense.
Very good. James Quinn, I took that line about giving Ireland its soul from a quote from Denny Lane, one of Davis's Trinity friends. It's quoted in the Dictionary of Irish Biography entry when his friend said, "Then indeed a soul came into Ireland," praising him. Looking at the years, the immediate years after his death, how significant was he seen as in those years? Because I think one of his friends tried to write a biography but didn't succeed. Was there a struggle over how his legacy would be portrayed?
Well, once he died, his friends did try to carry on his work. One of those I mentioned was Thomas McNevin. He actually tried to write, it was a single volume history of Ireland that Davis had tried to write, and he didn't succeed. And it actually caused him such grief, such anguish, that he had a nervous breakdown and died in a mental asylum a couple of years afterwards. For quite a while, he's a figure. He's certainly a presence. He's a presence through primarily, I would think, his historical verse, again, which as I mentioned is repeated over and over again at nationalist events. But how central he is arguable. I mean, what really happens is he has a kind of a resurrection in the 1880s and 1890s. You have Young Ireland societies grow up in the 1880s. And what they want to do is to remind people that there's more to Irish nationalism than politics and the land, which are the subjects that really dominate during the Parnell era. And what also a significant milestone, too, is Gavin Duffy's biography in 1890. So that, in a way, provides this image of this self-sacrificing, idealistic, prophetic Irishman, which is just what the literary revival generation are looking for. So that's why they take up Davis as a great hero. I mean, one of the names we haven't mentioned so far is William Rooney, who was a collaborator of Griffith. And Rooney really saw himself as a kind of latter-day Thomas Davis. So he very much inspired that literary revival generation, yeah.
And is there a sense that his stock increased in proportion to the decline in O'Connell's stock? Because whereas O'Connell was seen as maybe too Catholic, too traditional, maybe even too English in outlook, Davis was seen as the opposite of all of those things. He was Protestant, but he was representing an Irish nationalism that wasn't based on any religion. He was Irish in outlook. There was more of a cultural nationalism, all the very things that O'Connell didn't represent.
Yeah, and as well as that, I mean, Davis was seen as being disinterested from a financial point of view and very idealistic. I mean, Gavin Duffy draws this comparison in the biography where he mentions the amounts of money that O'Connell earns from the tribute. And he mentions then that Davis never even took a postage stamp from the repeal association. So in that way, particularly at a time when people are worried about, you know, place hunting was always seen as one of the great sins in Irish nationalism, that Davis was idealistic and not out for, you know, any kind of financial gain.
Very good. Gavin, you're an expert on commemoration, and we're going to be talking a lot in the second hour about some of the events of this decade of commemorations, 1912 to 1923. When you look at Davis and the issue of commemoration, given that this is the bicentenary of his birth, it does throw out some interesting questions that might be useful for us as we reflect on how we should commemorate the events of 1916 and Home Rule and the War of Independence and so on. Do you have any thoughts for us or any advice on maybe what can we learn from looking at previous commemorations of Davis, and maybe does it point the way for how we should approach these kind of things and maybe some things that we should try and avoid?
Yeah, it's a tough question to answer. I mean, I think the importance of commemoration is trying to not use it for political ends, even though that's almost inevitable, I think, in politics. But it's about immersing yourself in the complexity of the time that these people lived and what happened and what they're involved in. I mean, it's interesting, 45, that it was, even though he's a fairly uncontentious figure in some ways, but it was political in dull debates between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael about using Davis for, you know, to suit Fianna Fáil's ascendancy and using it for Fianna Fáil's political ends. I mean, you have, you know, for example, Dillon, who was a grandson of one of the nation's founders, who wrote, you know, about letting the dead rest, and Davis would turn his grave if he saw Fianna Fáil desecrating their memory. And you know, that Fianna Fáil understood Davis and Young Ireland as much as a flea understands an elephant. I mean, there was some great debates between Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil about the vision that the type of Davis that Fianna Fáil were putting out there, you know, to the public. But, you know, I think it's very different, obviously, now with the current commemorations of the events of 1914 to 16 to 1922-23, because this is commemorating a process, events, violence, war, rather than just one individual who was very much a thinker and a philosopher of nationality. So yeah, I mean, it's difficult to learn any lessons from this, apart from the fact that there's always going to be hostility to how it's done. I mean, at the time, there was hostility to the flag waving and the bombast and so on that was going on in 45 from many quarters, saying that, look, money should be spent elsewhere, you know, not on these big public spectacles. I mean, what exactly is this achieving, apart from some sort of national soul-searching?
Very good. Okay, well, we're almost out of time, but struck by what Gavin said there about Davis being a philosophy of nationalism and what you said earlier about him maybe being one of the thinkers rather than the doers of Irish history, I'll give the final thought to you, Eustace, then, about Davis. And maybe, I suppose, it's as we're in this bicentenary year of his birth, how should we remember Davis? Should we just find a good version of A Nation once again and have a hearty sing of that? Or should we read some of his historical writings? Should we go and look at some of the... What's the way of, I suppose, remembering him?
I'm not going to tell anybody what to do, but I think it'd be nice if people, if Thomas Davis would be, or remembering Thomas Davis would be a way of, or encouraging people to reflect on the content of nationalism, of their nationalism, of their Irishness. You know, because that's not frequently done. People think I'm Irish, therefore this is what it is. And actually the fact that people did not see themselves as nationalist in a way we think about nationalism, and we see, you know, in the world all around us what nationalism can do, if it's used unthinking, it'd be nice to reflect on him, because the content of his writing can be, I think, quite inspirational in a very positive sense.
Okay, well, that's a perfect note on which to end our discussion. My thanks to all my guests, Dr. James Quinn, Gavin Finlay, Dr. Eustace Augustine, and earlier Dr. Kieran O'Neill. We'll be back with more Talking History after the news.
Thanks for listening to this Newstalk 106 to 108 podcast. To download other programmes or for more information, go to newstalk.ie.